Welcome, welcome, welcome all our fellow Freedom Likers to this, the first episode of season four. Now, season four of Legally Drunk. We've been doing this for over a year. Very, very, very excited to be back. I, of course, am your host, Jakey Burtis, and I'm joined by the guy who holds the record for most back muscles pulled in a two-year span, Corey Pressel.
Jake, I'm super excited to be here, as always, and thank you for pointing out my injuries that I've struggled with much of my life.
Hey, I'm the runner-up to that world record, by the way. And how about this for a change? We are joined today also by the king of Somerset County himself, Louis Danowski.
Jake, it's good to be back. I checked when I last recorded a Legally Drunk episode. It was the end of June. I felt a hollowness in me, like a spiritual emptiness. It was the absence of doing these shows. So it's good. It's good to be back.
Filling voids is definitely our specialty. And no matter how good it is for you to be back, it's even better for us to have you back. So, we got a great show for you. As always, so much has happened in between the end of season three and the start of season four, but we're going to keep it as, I guess, narrow as we can here. So, we had two big gubernatorial elections happen recently in New Jersey and Virginia. We'll give you our thoughts on those and what we think the results mean for both parties. And also, the BIF, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, finally passed after a lot of back and forth in Congress. So we will give our thoughts on that as well and what that means for the overall Build Back Better agenda and what we think we can do with what we already have passed. So, without further ado, let's get right into it. So let's start breaking down these two big elections. Lou, I don't know about you, but to me, these elections can't really be talked about in tandem. I think they were two pretty different elections that I think, you know, in part because just because they happened on the same night, the media tried to kind of conflate as similar, whereas, you know, I don't think that was really the case at all. Let's start with the only state that matters, New Jersey.
Thank you.
We saw, of course, Phil Murphy win the election. Unfortunately, Jack Cittarelli has not yet conceded. But Lou, I know you were obviously, as it is your job, much more heavily involved in this election than I was. So why don't you give me your thoughts?
These unvarnished thoughts might get me into trouble. For the uninitiated, I am the executive director for the Somerset County Democrats. I basically lead the day-to-day operations of a county in New Jersey that really has become more of a bellwether. It's the quintessential suburbs that shifted away from Trump, and you got a lot of Republicans switching parties. So it went heavily to Joe Biden. It is way more temperamental than that. You cannot go by the way it votes in presidential elections anymore. Because it was historically extraordinarily Republican, generally very wealthy, a lot of old school Republicans, a lot of fiscal conservative Republicans. That's the ethos of the county, with the exception of a couple dense pockets. I was interfacing with the Murphy campaign a lot, because their focus was the 21 county strategy. The problem is the ethos of the campaign was closer to that of the Hillary campaign. And I think the bigger mistake of it, and it rubbed off on me all the same, because Jake, you can point to the text messages I saw that I sent to you, which is that good polling data begets good polling data, and it begets complacency and overconfidence. And I know at an intellectual level, you always have to run from behind. You have to run scared, not scared, but you have to run like you're going to lose. And I tried to run our county candidates as such, our legislative candidates as such, our local candidates as such. But at the end of the day, when I saw Murphy, I was like, oh, well, Murphy has it in the bag. I think the reason why Somerset was able to perform so well as a county, and for reference, they performed about as well as the state 51-48 to Murphy with a very high voter turnout, higher than like Passaic County, Hudson County, like bigger than a lot of Democratic strongholds, is because you ran your locals as if they were running scared. But the top of the ticket has an impact. And so you can run your locals like you're running from behind. But if you don't pay attention to what Murphy's doing, some of those locals are going to get swept away in the wave. If you're not working enough to either talk about Murphy, why people should vote for him, that's what people are often going out to vote for. They're either going out to vote for their local candidates, they're going out to vote for or against the top ticket. That's often what it comes down to. And you have to figure out how you're going to cater to that campaign. We tried to keep all our politics as local as possible, but it ended up losing us several municipalities because there was just too much of a red wave in some of these municipalities for Jack that we lost local seats. And the only reason that we were able to keep Democratic control at the county level is because we have a couple Democratic towns that are heavily Democratic. And then the towns that typically go Republican still have a strong Democratic presence, turn out a lot of voters, you get it done. But I think people in the Murphy campaign got a little bit fat and happy. I don't think Murphy was good about running on his accomplishments. He had several things in his back pocket he should have run on. I think he ran too hard on COVID. I think he ran too hard on mandates. I think he didn't have a good answer to the, albeit manipulated, quote,
100%.
If taxes are your issue, we're probably not your state. He did not have a good answer for it. He also did not have a good answer on housing, affordable housing, which is a big fight in a lot of local races. People forget that. He did not have a good answer for that. He also did not have a good answer for education. The problem is he has good answers. He didn't provide any on the trail about like school funding formulas, why they are the way they are, what exactly Cittarelli was proposing, how it's not going to help people, how it's going to further disadvantage inner city kids. Like, he didn't have a good answer to that. And I think at the end of the day, he missed what people were voting for. And instead of running on progressive accomplishments, he became a status quo candidate and no one was enthused to vote for him.
Yeah, I think the end there is the most salient point. Cittarelli, I think, was able to turn it pretty effectively into a referendum on Murphy. I'm not sure that was the smartest strategy for him, but I think conventional electoral wisdom says as a challenger to an incumbent, that's what you want to do. I do have, real quick, this just dropped, some news that just dropped, being reported by Politico that Cittarelli is going to concede tomorrow morning. It's Politico, so take from that what you will, but they are reporting that he is finally planning on conceding, which I'm kind of split on whether or not he should have conceded right away. I see why he didn't. New Jersey has fairly simple, we don't have an automatic recall statute or automatic recount statute, but it is fairly simple, I think, to get a recount in New Jersey. Lou, I think the most salient point that you may not have touched on in your analysis was that this was the lowest turnout gubernatorial election, I believe, on record in New Jersey. I believe we only had less than 37% turnout, something in that vein. I personally find that to be a little bit of a statewide disgrace, but I spoke to a lot of people who are more in the middle and who didn't end up voting.
I've got to be honest, I'm not sure after all the tallies came in it was, because about 500,000 more people voted in this election than in 2017. And I don't know if we got 500,000 more registered voters in those 4 years.
There were a lot of people who registered in 2020.
I know. It felt like a very low turnout election, but I'm not necessarily convinced it was the lowest once all the data comes in.
Fair enough. And data is still trickling in. I think Murphy's lead will increase a little bit. I think we only have 95% of the votes counted so far. Mm-hmm. But either way, this was a low turnout election. I'm fairly confident in saying that.
It was.
Part of that's just because it's an off-year election. But I think part of that was, I don't think moderates or a lot of moderates were really enthralled with either candidate, especially more of the right-leaning moderates. Because I think most people in New Jersey feel that Murphy has done a decent job, maybe not like an amazing job in the minds of more right-leaning moderates, but there's nothing about him that's like overtly offensive, I think, to most people. Mm-hmm. Whereas Cittarelli, I think they may tend to like a lot of what he has to say and hated a lot of what he had to say. And that kind of led to them, or a lot of people, not really being too hype about voting for either of them. It's something I'm personally not sympathetic to, but I'm empathetic to. Like, it's something I would never do and don't necessarily agree with. Like, I think there's always a candidate who's at least marginally better than the other. And if you can find that, you should vote for that person, even if you don't love them much more than the other person. But I am empathetic in the sense that, like, I can see where you're coming from, especially if you're someone who's not like super into politics. And if you're not super into politics, you're probably not voting in an off-year election anyway. Lou, my main takeaway from New Jersey is that the doom and gloom narrative for the Democrats is very much overblown. And this wasn't some sort of like razor thin victory for Murphy. When all's said and done, he's going to have won by a few points. It's not as high as he probably should have or could have won by, but it's not as if this was like a few votes go the other way, Cittarelli wins. I think this was a decisive win for Murphy. And he was the first Democrat in New Jersey to have been reelected as governor since, I've seen two numbers. I believe it's 1989 or 88.
89.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Democrats usually don't get reelected very easily in New Jersey. He bucked that trend. And I don't think this is a state where Democrats really need to worry all that much. I think the word that you touched on that is the key here, I think, is local. Because local is what people feel and see every day. That's what's in their lives. And COVID was a big, that's why COVID, I think, is such a big mover for people on both sides of the aisle, because it's something you can touch and see every single day. And it's something that affects you on a daily basis. So I don't think the New Jersey Republicans did an amazing job in mobilizing around that, nor do I think it was necessarily their best strategy, just in the sense of, I think people in New Jersey are pretty much pro mandate in general. They're pro masks in schools in general. I think you have a very vocal minority in New Jersey who's opposed to that, but I don't think you're going to be able to mobilize a lot of people against a lot of the COVID restrictions. I see that as something that's happened.
Don't necessarily agree. I don't think the minority is small and vocal. I think it's big and quiet. So it's like the politically disengaged voter who might support some sort of democratic policy positions, but they're really just worried about like their bottom line and their kids and their job. And they see, oh, more mandates, like another thing we have to do. Like, it's not anti-science. It's not like anti-safety. It's not go to a school board and start screaming. It's just, oh my God, we've put up with this for a year and a half. I'm tired of it. I'm vaccinated. Like, Can we just get on with it? Like, I think people are just over it. And I think most people want to do the right thing and they want their kids to be safe. But this idea of like, we have to keep talking about it, I think people are just tired of it. And Murphy had to make a lot of tough and a lot of unpopular calls in 2020. And one of his biggest campaign messages was, we're not going back. The problem is, you have to pair that message with exclusively cannabis, minimum wage, family leave, community college. I heard him talk more about COVID. I heard you see the more viral messages about him calling people knuckleheads, which to me, like, as a liberal, is very funny, and I get it, but in retrospect, looks a little bit more like your deplorables type comment. Mm-hmm. He was running a little bit too hard on being Captain COVID when he didn't have to. It left him vulnerable to attacks like the nursing home call, shutdowns that he enacted where small businesses went under.
Yeah.
And while the state was decent with unemployment relief, their unemployment office was woefully understaffed and underprepared for it. Mm-hmm. So you can't run on the unemployment office working well, even if you can run on having decent unemployment policy. Those are two different things. And so when you run on being Captain COVID, all of your tough, you're vulnerable to attacks on all the tough calls you have to make, as opposed to easy legislative accomplishments that most people agree with. And I think that's why it was easy for Cittarelli to make it a Murphy referendum. And it's not about a vote, it's not about having a huge anti-mask population. It's people are over it. Like, New Jersey's over it. They're done with it. They're 70% vaccinated.
I think I agree with everything you said except for this one point where I think the group of people you're describing 100% exists, and I think it makes up, I like you said, maybe not in these words, but the silent majority. The difference is I don't think those people mobilized around Cittarelli.
No, they just didn't vote. They didn't vote. That's what happened.
Well, I think a lot of them didn't vote, or I think I would think most New Jerseyans who fall into that category that you just described blame not Murphy for the reason the pandemic's still going on and there are still mandates. I think they blame largely the unvaccinated people who tend to lean more to the right. I don't think they saw Cittarelli as a cure to that in any way, shape, or form.
No, I think it was just not a message to mobilize Democrats. I think it was a misfire. I'll tell you what, I, as a vaccinated, very liberal individual, did not feel mobilized around a COVID hawk message.
Yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah, no, I mean,
and if I were not working in politics, that wouldn't have inspired me to vote. Now, if I were not as liberal, even in general, maybe I wouldn't have been thrilled with where my property taxes were at. I don't pay property taxes. I rent. So right. I'm not pissed off about my bottom line in the same way as homeowners are. And the issues of property taxes go way beyond Phil Murphy, but he didn't explain mm-hmm. that well. It goes far beyond him. It goes far beyond Jack. People in New Jersey care about their taxes. You say taxes in New Jersey, and then everyone gets fired up, even Democrats, because it is a fiscally progressive state. But as soon as people feel like their tax dollars get wasted, they get pissed off. It's New Jersey. People get pissed off. They're not afraid to get pissed off.
Yeah.
So I think that's what you're up against. And I think that's the case you have to make in a state like New Jersey. And mm-hmm. I think you saw Democrats sit out because they just didn't care. They were like,
yeah.
Or you saw independents who just didn't care. They're like, right. Murphy, I don't care if Murphy goes out in flames. They might not vote for Jack. They're not going to vote. They'll just, it's like 2016. They'll just, not that Murphy's way more progressive than Hillary is or was. But it's the same voter apathy. I don't care. Ah, whatever. Who gives a, like, that's it.
I think Murphy's more liked than Hillary is, but at the same time, I think it's hard for you and me. Yeah, I think it's hard for you and me to like identify exactly what it is, just in the sense that like I don't think you or I, just because of how, you know, wired into politics we are the typical voter in a lot of ways. And, you know, we don't own homes. We don't own property. We don't pay property taxes. We pay other taxes. But for me, I mean, all I can really do is speak for myself. I think I track a little bit more moderate than you do, but nevertheless, what motivated me was, I mean, I like Murphy to begin with. I'm not like overtly in love with him, but I like him. And when I heard Chitterelli talking about like, you know, rolling back protections on LGBTQ people, like that really pisses me off. Like when I hear him not say the election was stolen, but not come out and say the opposite either, that really pisses me off. And for me, the biggest thing, and I think I expressed that on this show, is when I hear him say, I'm going to cut your taxes. I'm going to cut your taxes. You're taxed too much. I'm going to cut your taxes. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But you're just saying you're going to cut taxes. That is not a position. That is a goal. You're going to cut whose taxes? You're going to in turn raise whose taxes? You are going to cut spending on what? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, those are all things I need answers to if I'm going to vote for you, and you didn't provide them.
That, though, Jake, in fairness, is something that someone more wired into politics would think. Most people would see. I had this discussion with my parents, who both voted for Murphy, and my mom was fine with it. My dad was a little bit more begrudging about it, because he was like, I don't dislike Murphy, but it's more an anti-Jack vote. He's always pissed off about his taxes, but has shifted away from having that be a justification to vote for Republicans who are willing to undermine a lot of other policy goals. So
yeah,
that's the rub. It's not like if you campaign on cutting taxes in New Jersey, it kind of works most of the time.
Yeah.
Regardless of what your details are.
Although I you're absolutely right. I do think it's becoming somewhat of a less effective message, though, or at least Chitterelli, I don't think, was a great communicator of that message. Like,
he wasn't.
So in speaking with my dad, who's a Republican, although he's anti-Trump, he voted for Biden and Hillary, but he's definitely a Republican. In speaking to him, he told me he didn't vote, didn't like Chitterelli, and he doesn't really hate Murphy, but he wasn't going to vote for him either. Mm-hmm. And the reasons he gave, and I think he was spot on with this, is it's like, yeah, if I actually thought Chitterelli was going to cut my taxes, I'd consider voting for him. But I don't think there's any way, even if he was elected, he would actually do it or be able. And it's not even for a lack of will per se. It's just, I don't think he'd be able to do it if he actually got elected.
No. Do you know why? Because people like your dad see how the sausage is made. New Jersey has 565 municipalities. Most of people's tax woes come from property taxes, of which pay for municipal services. So if you have 565 discrete municipalities and your tax base in many of those municipalities is 10 to 20,000 people, then you have to tax the shit out of property unless you want to merge services, which goes over well in certain areas, in certain situations, but not necessarily in others. And it does not necessarily cut along ideological lines. So it's a much broader discussion to be had about taxes.
Yeah, and we can go on for taxes in New Jersey for a long time. But I think one thing all New Jersey voters are really pissed off about is the cap on the state income tax write-off. And that was, of course, a Trump proposal that at least our representative, Tom Malinowski, who's a Democrat, is fighting hard to get changed. I don't think he'll be successful. I think the Democrats in New Jersey have done a decent job in arguing against. Now, my dad had an interesting theory, and this is probably for another time, that when Trump runs again, one of his platforms should be on reversing the state income tax cap that he himself imposed, and he could get more support in the Northeast that way. I don't think that's a good strategy for him. I don't think that would amount to anything, but it's a funny thought.
He's never going to win Northeastern states anyway.
That's what I tried to communicate to my dad.
He disagrees, it's funny. It's funny, but in an electoral college system, it's never going to work because he'll never win the Northeast.
And even if he did, like, it probably means he won the Midwest too, which doesn't matter.
Here's the other thing about, you bring up a good point with salt. People in New Jersey in 2021 are probably angrier about their taxes now because SALT was not repealed. But right. Cittarelli was trying to channel that frustration at Murphy as if that were his fault, which it's not. It's his own party's leadership at a federal level that overturned it. And right. So that becomes like the rub there. And that's what Cittarelli was trying to do. But it's like, I think that if you can effectively channel that emotion about, wow, I really got screwed because of the $10,000 salt cap, and channel that into voting against Murphy because of taxes, you probably galvanized a fair bit of voters over that, even if it's misattributed.
Yeah. We could talk about New Jersey until the cows come home, but...
Greatest state in the union, baby. Greatest state.
100%. 100%. But either way, let's transition over to Virginia, which I think in some ways was kind of the opposite of the New Jersey election, even though, like I said, I think the media tried to conflate the two. As we mentioned, even if I end up being wrong about it being the lowest voter turnout in New Jersey history, Virginia was amongst the highest turnout for a gubernatorial election in the history of their state, and might have even have been the highest, 55% voter turnout, which is pretty insane in an off-year election. We saw Youngkin, the Republican, defeat McAuliffe, who was the former governor. Virginia, if you don't know, has a strange rule where you are only allowed to serve one term and then you have to leave. Your term limited out at that point, but I guess you can run again. Youngkin won with a 50.57% of the vote to McAuliffe's 48.64% of the vote. So less than 2%, fairly close, still a convincing victory for Youngkin. So if you're unaware, Youngkin took more of a, I think, traditional Republican approach, I think is the fair thing to say. He largely ignored Donald Trump, in some instances went out of his way to disassociate himself from Trump, which I think was a very good strategy. Virginia, of course, is, even though it's fairly purple on a national scale, it pretty much always votes Democrat. Biden won the state pretty handily, if I'm not mistaken. The main thing that most quote-unquote experts, I guess, cite to, one of the things Youngkin was able to do effectively is really galvanize support around mandates in schools, and he did a little bit with CRT, a lot of these education concerns, and I think that really gets at the heart of what I was speaking about earlier, which These are things that people can kind of see and tangibly not touch in a literal sense, but, you know, touch and feel on a daily basis. You know, these are things that can get the average voter up and out of bed because they're things that people can understand, even though they don't understand CRT even a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's not hard to see how that affects your daily life. I think the other big thing he did well, and this ties in with education, was play to this malaise people have about COVID in a way that I don't think Murphy was really able to do. He came off not as anti-mask or anti-vax or anti-science. He just came off as, hey, look, I'm somebody who's going to end the pandemic, not in the way of getting people vaccinated. I'm just going to stop talking about it. It was basically how his policy broke down to me. COVID in 2020 was a huge deal and maybe even the determining factor in the election. It's, again, really gets to the heart of this thing that it affects everybody on a daily basis, and it's something that is tangible. You know, we've seen Biden's poll numbers dropping, you know, in the past however long, but recently, and people have speculated it's for a myriad of reasons, you know, Afghanistan not passing legislation, et cetera, et cetera. That's all a load of crap. His poll numbers are down purely because of COVID, in my semi-professional opinion. They will continue to go down until this pandemic is ended. What does that mean? I have no idea what it means to end the pandemic. And I don't think Youngkin really had a great answer for that either. Although kind of the genius of it is it's kind of up to the individual. He says, I'm going to end the pandemic, and the individual just infers in their own mind what they think ending the pandemic means. And one thing I am worried about in more moderate areas, I don't know if this is necessarily going to be the case with Trump, but in 2024, I am somewhat worried, and in 2020, especially, or excuse me, 2022 especially, one thing I am worried about is the Republicans kind of being able to turn around the COVID issue back on Biden, because one of the biggest things Biden ran on was, you know, we're going to get COVID under control and we're going to end the pandemic. You can very easily argue, you know, he hasn't done that yet. So that was my biggest takeaway from this election.
I think Virginia is a tougher nut to crack. I think you point out a lot of the right things. Virginia is not the safe bet that that New Jersey is in some ways, even though it's moving blue.
You know, not to cut you off, I really thought McAuliffe had no chance in this election. I was surprised it was even this close. Like, I thought Youngkin was going to, I actually thought Youngkin was going to win the whole time.
I mean, I thought it would be close, but I think McAuliffe was.
Well, I guess close is relative, right?
Right. But I mean, this was pretty close.
It was fairly close, yeah.
Like, it wasn't overwhelming. And that's sort of how I feel about New Jersey election too. Was not
Youngkin won by a little less than 2 points, about, we'll call it 2 points. I thought he would probably win by 4 or 5.
So basically all things considered in Virginia, I think voters can deal with higher taxes, but they can't deal with being disrespected. And I think that gaffe that I'm sure McAuliffe regrets, where he says, I don't think parents should have a say in their kids' education, I think was sort of the quintessential disrespect of parental agency over their kids' upbringing that I think is able to piss off voters to the point where, like, they might not want to see the bigger picture of, oh, well, what is Youngkin going to do for a policy that doesn't affect me? Versus like, oh, you made it personal. Like, it was not the gaffe heard around the state.
I don't care that Youngkin's going to make it impossible to get an abortion in Virginia anymore. McAuliffe hurt my feelings, basically.
Well,
no,
yeah.
Like, he touched a nerve, though. I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, he touched a nerve. And Youngkin was very tactical about how he ran his campaign.
He ran a great campaign.
He sort of effectively, I'll tell you what he effectively did. He effectively targeted every echo chamber and exploited the fact that people consume media within their echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he goes on Tucker Carlson or Newsmax and starts talking about things, the Republicans who consume that are going to vote against Democrats anyway. But he can say the right things to sort of galvanize them, but then go out on the broader campaign trail at large, have plausible deniability behind what he says, talk more about kitchen table issues, and those same people, more independents, are not going to consume the media.
The Newsmax, Fox News stuff, yeah.
Of that, where they see Youngkin and get turned off because he's on Newsmax or he's talking about critical race theory or whatever the hot button issue is in conservative media. He was able to play like a very innocent, uncontroversial, everyday guy kind of figure that sort of diffused any sort of harsh attacks against him.
Yeah, he was playing the suburban dad. That's what his whole campaign was about.
It worked.
It worked, and he needed to pitch a perfect game for it to work, and he did.
But here's the thing, you didn't even have to pitch a perfect game. I mean, McAuliffe, you want to talk about Clinton-esque, 2016-esque candidates?
Mm-hmm.
Like, McAuliffe was that. You know, no one is galvanized to vote for the establishment of the establishment. Like a former governor who has fairly moderate beliefs, but also appears to look down on everyday people. Like, give me a break.
Right.
No one's going to vote for that.
Especially, like, I don't know if you heard.
There was a primary challenge against him. There was a more left flank candidate that maybe you could get your base out to vote for. But when Youngkin was running totally, he was sort of running this two-faced campaign. It makes it very hard to try to occupy the same lane as like the everyday guy.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw or heard McAuliffe's interview on Pod Save America. As soon as I heard that interview, like, I knew this guy wasn't going to win.
When was it?
It was a few weeks ago. You could tell he was so desperate to try and capture some of that everyman vibe. Like, he did literally, I think, like 15 minutes on, I was the first governor to put a keg in the governor's mansion. Or to install like a tap in the governor's mansion.
Did he really say that?
Yeah, which he did. And he was like, I'm proud of the fact that like whenever random people would show up at the governor's mansion, I'd invite them in for 15 minutes and we'd have and give them a beer and we'd talk politics or whatever they wanted to talk about. And I'm like, it's kind of cool, but like that's not going to swing the needle for anybody. And it comes off as kind of desperate, aside from the fact that he made a debatably homophobic remark to Love It as well. But
oh no, what did he say?
I was like, I just wrote that one off as like, he doesn't mean anything by it, he's just too old. You could tell they were trying to like placate him with the keg thing, so they were like, they asked them, so what kind of beer you get there? I'm not a big IPA guy myself, I think IPAs suck. And then McAuliffe goes, oh, I bet you're like a big rosé guy, Lovin', or something like that. Which would be the Lovin' is famously homosexual. So. Yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was funny a little bit, but at the same time, I'm like, you know what? You probably shouldn't have said that. Like, Lovin' like took it all in stride. You know what? It bothered me too, because I'm also a big rosé guy. I love a good rosé, and I don't love IPAs. Love It took it all in stride, and he's like, yeah, of course, I love rosé. Like, rosé is great, which is probably like the perfect thing to say there. But McAuliffe also, what bothered me is McAuliffe also had a good answer to the question. He could have just been like, yeah, I sourced this local Virginia brewery's beer for the mansion. I'm like, you could have just said that. Just say that. You know, a narrative that I've heard that I completely disagree with the Virginia election was, you know, just trying to tie these Republican candidates to Trump is a losing strategy. I don't think that's true. I know that was McAuliffe's main strategy, and so it makes sense why people think that it's a losing strategy, but I just don't think it was an effective strategy against Youngkin. We saw Chitterelli try and do the same thing, like play a careful, I'm going to try and distance myself from Trump. I don't think he did it as well as Youngkin did. McAuliffe like even took to calling him Glenn Trumpkin and everything, which was kind of like a decent nickname, I thought. But I don't think it's going to move the needle for anybody. I think there was never like really a huge moment or I guess gaffe Youngkin had that could easily tie him to Trump. The big thing McAuliffe had was what Youngkin said in the fundraiser. You know, I'm not allowed to talk about abortion on the campaign trail, but trust me, I'll do the, I think he said, quote unquote, the right thing when it comes to abortion. I think that was the big, that was the big thing that McAuliffe tried to nail him on.
Right.
And it didn't really work, even though I think abortion is traditionally an issue that galvanizes voters on both sides of the aisle. But he wasn't really able to make abortion a big issue here. I think that was somewhat of a misstep. I think he should have laid into the abortion argument a little bit more. But this, and this is something that kind of bothers me with the Democratic Party right now. And I understand why they do it. But Democrats never really play into the, on this show, I feel comfortable calling them bullshit arguments, but I would never, or bullshit issues, I would never say that to a person who's a Trump supporter. But yeah, their issues, the issues, and I use that in air quotes, that they bring up are things that just objectively do not matter. Dr. Mm-hmm. Seuss does not matter. Mr. Potato Head does not matter. Trans women in sports does not matter. These are bullshit issues. And even if they do matter to you, which they very well might, it's not something the government needs to, it's not the government's problem. But that's just my take, unless you can articulate how somebody's civil rights are being violated, which I don't think you necessarily can.
It's the culture war. That's going to be the 2022 midterms.
Right. And I get why Democrats don't want to engage with stupid shit like that, but like I think they should, because I think we can win on most of those issues. Like
if they come down on the right side of it, but I don't trust the Democrats to do that.
See, the Democrats can very easily shoot themselves in the foot on these types of issues. You're absolutely
Democrats.
Correct.
Democrats are just a party of self-inflicted wounds.
That is a truer statement has never been spoken.
I am a Democrat. We are a party of self-inflicted wounds.
Always. Okay?
And we cannot, I think, like get dragged into the culture wars in such a way that we are defending against every single Republican attack. The way you do it is you try to go and start making your own attacks that get your base riled up. You don't go, the Republicans say, oh, the Democrats want to cancel Mr. Potato Head. And we say, no, we don't want to cancel Mr. Potato Head. In fact, we want to, you know, give Mr. Potato Head a bra. Like, that's not what you do. You have to hit back on things that actually make your Democrats show up.
You're right. But here's my thing on it. Stick with the Mr. Potato Head example. Republicans say Democrats want to cancel Mr. Potato Head. Or no, or I think their argument with that was Democrats want to make Mr. Potato Head trans. Was their whole thing with that. And you should say, and the counter argument has to be, no, Democrats want to defend Hasbro or whatever company owns Mr. Potato Head. I think it's Hasbro. Hasbro's right to free market enterprise and their right to practice capitalism by packaging both the Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head pieces in a single box. That is capitalism and that is progress, and that is what Democrats stand for. The same thing with Dr. Seuss. We are defending whatever company owns Dr. Seuss's right to practice free market enterprise. What you call cancel culture, we call free market enterprise. We call that capitalism. We call that the basis of the American economic might right, the and problem, system.
The problem is Democrats don't lean into not talking about the issue. They lean into the trap. They lean into defending the issue. Yeah, of course we want trans, blah, blah, blah.
You're 100% right. That's the problem.
But you have to reframe the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Can't say, oh yeah, of course say, of course Mr. Potato Head should be trans. What bigot doesn't agree with me? No.
No, that's not the point.
You say, it doesn't matter what I think about Mr. Potato Head because this is a free country. Right? Just like you said, and Hasbro can do whatever it wants. But they never do that. They never do it.
And it's not about making him trans. It's about a cost-cutting measure for Hasbro.
They always they defend the straw man. That's what happens. They defend the straw man.
What you need to do, it's like what Obama always said. Like, you need to not take the bait. You need to call out the game that they're playing.
Exactly. But Democrats have become increasingly bad.
They're really bad at it.
And I think something that you're starting to see with the educational shift in party realignment is a real sense of elitism.
See, that's something that's always existed.
I know, but it's particularly bad now.
Because I mean, that's how you
get... For Democrats, because Republicans... First of all, I think more wealthy people tended to be Republican than Democrat, but I think considering that there were wealthy influences in both parties, it was fairly even. Now with the educational shift, I actually think you are concentrating educational and monetary capital into one party in such a way that you're starting to see sort of the collective groupthink of that shift in terms of how people talk about people they disagree with or positions.
Yeah, and that shift is it's been something that's in progress. I think Trump accelerated it a little bit, but it was always something that was in progress, largely in part to the fact that women who tend to lean more to the left are graduating college at a much higher rate now, and they are actually graduating college at a higher rate than men are. The shift we're talking about is college-educated voters are now a majority Democrat, which was not the case even just a few years ago, and college-educated voters also tend to hate Trump. And there's a myriad of other factors. I think the gender factor is the primary mover of this trend that we're seeing. But that's how you get, you know, people on the right, and we've mentioned this before, like Josh Hawley, slamming elite coastal universities in spite of the fact that he himself went to Stanford and Yale Law School. And like Ted Cruz doing the same thing, having attended Harvard Law School. You cannot get more elite coastal university than that, but it doesn't really matter. It plays down into this thing that I've been researching and analyzing a lot of, and that one thing I hate is when we call the other side stupid and the other side calls us stupid. Like, that's very much not the case, at least talking about our representatives and elected officials. You know, 95% of the people in Congress are highly, highly intelligent people, regardless of what they say or how they act. There are some people who I think are legitimately stupid. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is legitimately stupid. I think Lauren Boebert is legitimately stupid. But Ted Cruz isn't legitimately stupid. Ted Cruz is a very, very smart man who is incentivized politically to say a lot of dumb shit. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Josh Hawley.
Exactly. They're actors, but it doesn't necessarily change
the result.
The result. Yeah. It doesn't change anything. And that's
and back to what you were saying about the straw man. I don't know if you got a chance to watch that video I sent you. It was the Bill Maher, Sean Spicer interview on Real Time. I think it was a couple weeks ago. David Pakman did a great job analyzing that interview of why you can't really argue with conspiracy theorists live. I'm not equating a lot of the main Republican talking points to conspiracy theories, although conspiracy theories do seem to be playing a bigger and bigger part of their voter base's mindset. I don't think that's a controversial statement at this point, but what Sean Spicer did when they talked about the election is he threw out 10 different reasons as to why he thinks the election was stolen. Bill Maher was able to refute like 6 of them very confidently. But the fact that he wasn't able to refute 4 of them, you leave the interview thinking, wait a minute, Sean Spicer doesn't sound like a total idiot here. What David Pakman did, of course, this was after the fact, this wasn't live, was he very eloquently refuted every single one of Sean Spicer's points. And it was very clear that every single thing he said during the interview is complete bullshit. But it doesn't come off that way live, because as long as there's one little made up thing that the person you're arguing against can't refute, you come off looking smart. It's a total mismatch and it's a total double standard. But that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, in real, like, if you can't refute it with the data in real time, you look like you're on the defensive, and that's not good.
And Sean Spicer just said, like, the Wisconsin Supreme Court voted 7-2, blah, 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 on that case, and Bill had no idea what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about, and most people probably didn't. And then David was very eloquently like, yeah, the Republican Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that these ballots can't be thrown out. Like, there's nothing there. It's a total red herring.
Exactly.
And on the election point, just in general, I don't want to get into too much of this right now, but basically, like, I think this is what a game a lot of the Republicans are playing right now. And I saw Madison Hawthorne kind of make the same point in a talk he gave at Dartmouth. I don't know why he was at Dartmouth or why Dartmouth even invited him to speak, but he spoke at Dartmouth. I think that they're equating something being unethical or something like seeming like this wasn't the best way to have the system work to something being illegal. I'm trying to give you a concrete example here, but like the head of the Wisconsin Elections Board can make some sort of unilateral decision about polling places. I would even agree that's probably a shitty way to run an election. And that's probably, you can make an argument that that's somewhat unethical, but there is nothing illegal about that. That's what it says under Wisconsin law. And the Republicans are trying to equate this seems shady on the surface, and it seems like this isn't the way the election should have been run, to it was illegal. And those are two completely different things.
They're good at tapping into the uncertainty of certain processes and then twisting that in people's minds to make them think there's some sort of nefarious operation going on.
Which David also, I thought, made an excellent point here, which is like, all they have to do is cast a little bit of doubt, and it doesn't even really prove the point that they're trying to make, but it still like works. So let's say like the Wisconsin secretary did do something illegal that casts doubt on Biden having won the state, for example. One that does not mean Trump would have won Wisconsin automatically. We would have to look at that too. And two, even if Trump did win Wisconsin, he still would have lost the election. So it really makes no difference. But
well,
it makes no difference, but we
saw this as early as like what, 2010 or whatever in the mainstream media. Bill O'Reilly debates that like atheist, and he goes like, "You can't explain that. You can't explain that. Like, you know, sun goes up, sun goes down, never a miscommunication." And like the guy who he was debating basically was like totally on the defensive the whole time, because Bill O'Reilly was able to get him. It's a good video.
Yeah,
and it's a good masterclass of like how to sow a little bit of doubt, a little bit of doubt. Because, like, Bill O'Reilly's very religious, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I ever saw that one. I saw the Bill Nye the Science Guy and Ken Ham, who's the leader of, like, it's basically like the leader of creationism right now as a science. I saw those two debate, and I personally thought Bill completely wiped the floor with him, but I could see, like, I'm sure Bill at the same time didn't convince a single religious person that there is no God, or maybe you should doubt the existence of God. And I thought, I forget who it was, but somebody, a pundit, made a great point. Like, it was a mistake for Bill to even have, like, engaged in this practice, because you're just, in debating them, you're giving them more credibility and more legitimacy.
And in some ways you are, because you give them a platform.
It's not to say we shouldn't be debating people, but we should only be debating good faith actors.
Exactly. And that's sometimes a tough thing to suss out, who really stands by their bullshit and who doesn't stand by their bullshit.
Because as it stands right now, we have politicians who are incentivized to not be good faith actors and to not be serious people. Mm-hmm. I am a supporter of left or right. I am a supporter of serious people who have actual principles.
Absolutely.
That seems to be at a premium these
days. And in some ways you could say they're representing their constituents, which is a whole separate problem.
Well, that's just the whole George Carlin bit of, we don't have any right to complain about our politicians because the politicians come from the public. It's not the politicians who suck. It's the public that sucks, which in essence reigns true. So, like I said at the top, we're going to give our thoughts on the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the BIF, passing. But first, Corey, let's go over to you.
So, Jake, as you mentioned, President Biden's $1 trillion infrastructure bill is slated to be signed by the president on Monday. This passage will be the first big win for Biden since passing the American Rescue Plan. Shifting gears a little bit, also on Monday, President Biden is slated to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping in a virtual summit between the two nations.
By the way, not to cut you off, I don't think it could be considered a summit if it's virtual. To me, that's just a Zoom call between the two countries. But continue.
The amount of star power on that call, though, come on. I didn't think Zoom servers could support something like that.
If I were to get a call with Winnie the Pooh himself, I'd be very enthralled.
Nice.
Early in November, Election Day proved to be a big day for Republicans and has left Democrats thinking hard about their messaging. Glenn Youngkin defeated former Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia's governor's race after steering much of the conversation toward education and what children are taught in school.
Did your parents vote in that election, by the way?
They did, and I will not share their what they voted for because it's not my place to do so.
Yeah. Did both of them vote for the same candidate or no? That's just all I'm curious about.
Well, I think that would reveal what their votes were if I answer no. So I won't say anything. Mm-hmm. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy barely edged out Republican Jack Cittarelli in the election. Despite being 2.6 percentage points behind, Cittarelli is refusing to concede. That's it.
Well, thank you for that update, Corey. Quick little news blast. And I will say, it's been a while. I am excited to have top fives back in my life again.
Yes. This one is totally, I mean, there definitely is some research that went into this, but I feel a lot of this was sort of spun up in my mind and concocted based on what I know of recent times. So that's the first thing I'll say, sort of looking at this top five as a whole, it's more recent in time. You have to think in that lens.
Okay.
The other thing that this top five specifically deals with is elections and what people were elected. The top five for this show is top five most confusing states politically.
Okay.
By who was elected in those states in any type of election. local elections, you know, state elections, federal elections, any of that sort of stuff. So top five most confusing states politically based on who was elected in those states.
Are we thinking of like a time frame? Is it like in...
I would say everything's been in the past 30 years.
Okay.
I've got a guess.
I've got a couple guesses too. Lou, why don't you go first?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is not in my top five. But tell me why you thought Pennsylvania would be in the top five.
It's an increasingly Trumpy state that still has Democratic supermajorities. I don't know if they're supermajorities, but Democratic majorities. They have a very Democratic Supreme Court. You can tell because they elect their judges. It went to Trump. It goes to Biden. It's like very purple. It's becoming increasingly polarized. So I think it's going to be a tough nut to crack and a bellwether for a lot of upcoming elections, more so than like Ohio in the future.
I would reject the notion, though, that it's growing in sort of its Trumpiness. I don't think that's the case. It's been a swing state for quite a while, and Biden's victory was more decisive than Trump's was in 2020 versus 2016. And it is, you know, as you stated, at the state level, much more blue than it is red. So I don't know that it's becoming more Trumpy, but that is a good point, everything that you said. But it is not on my top five.
See, Corey's a Pennsylvania resident, so maybe he's a little too close to it. But I will say... To me,
oh, come on.
to me, Pennsylvania is like not confusing at all. Like, it's confusing in the sense that it might be difficult to call, but it's a very, it might even be the most purple state. I think North Carolina is probably the most purple state, at least at the presidential level.
Like the quintessential purple state.
Yeah. And so to me, even though the fact that it's very difficult to call, that makes perfect sense. Like, that to me isn't necessarily confusing. Corey, I'm going to throw out Massachusetts.
Jake, you got number one.
What? Damn. This is what I do.
And I think you know why. And
is it Mitt Romney being the governor?
It's not Mitt Romney being the governor. It's the fact that all 11 of their congressmen, United States congressmen, are Democratic. All 11. And they've had a Republican governor for years that they love. That is the only state where that's the case. I mean, Vermont too, but you've also thrown in some other things there, like independence and everything else. But Massachusetts has a pure, it's the most Democratic state in terms of voting behind DC, but DC's not a state. And it has a very popular Republican governor and had Mitt Romney as a governor.
If you put I was not going to say this at first, but if you put Massachusetts as number one, then I think New Jersey also has to make that list. And I'll tell you why before you tell me whether or not it made the list.
Sure.
I will just throw out New Jersey was going to be my next guess. So
New Jersey is an equally blue state on paper. In presidential years, it goes at least 15%. In the Democratic direction and has been doing that for, I don't know, the past 20 years. But it has a nasty habit of electing Republican governors consistently. And just like Massachusetts, it's 11 of its 13. I forget. No, 10 of its 12. How many congressional districts?
Well, we just had one switch, right?
Yeah, hold on. 10 of its 12 congressional districts are represented by Democrats. And one of those, as Jake pointed out, was originally a Democrat who fled. So to me, New Jersey is an increasingly temperamental state in that regard and has elected Republican governors several times in the past 20, 30 years.
You were not wrong in anything you said. The reason I did not include New Jersey on the list, similar reason to Massachusetts, however, Massachusetts is much more politically confusing because New Jersey tends to flip to Republican in the governorship when there's out of a backlash from the first year because it elects their governors the year after the presidential election. It's sort of like a backlash, which to me is not nearly as politically confusing. That's easy to understand. Massachusetts did not elect Republican governors in a massive backlash. They did it because Republicans in Massachusetts are sort of amorphous and are able to grow their popularity with not necessarily identifying fully with what we now know to be the Republican Party, if that makes sense. Everything you said is right. New Jersey could have easily been on this list.
I think there are a lot of really similar principles that govern the two states, but I could maybe respect not putting it on. I'll have to see the rest of the list before I pass judgment.
I'm Jake, gonna throw you out, make a guess. Yeah.
I'm going to throw out Minnesota.
That is number three.
It's, Minnesota?
And Minnesota is, for a kind of silly reason, they've nominated, or not nominated, they've elected some pretty non-traditional people over time. Celebrity people. Their governor, Jesse Ventura. They had a comedian serve as one of their senators for a long period of time. And that's sort of where that came from on this list.
See, the thing with me with Jesse Ventura isn't even that he got elected. It's that he got elected as a member of the Reform Party. He got elected as a third-party candidate.
Exactly. That is why Minnesota's on the list.
Minnesota also is weird in that they're the state presidential nominee of one party has won the most consecutive elections. So I think Minnesota was the only... I think they were the only ones to vote for Mondale, and I think they were the only ones to vote against to vote for Humphrey as well.
No, Humphrey got more states. Humphrey got more than one state, I think. You're right about Mondale. All right, so you got number one and number three. I will say four and five on this list are on the list for a similar reason. Three or number two on the list is on the list for a different reason, something we have not talked about yet.
All right, I'm going to take another swing at it. Florida.
I was thinking Florida.
Not Florida. I feel so bad. Lou is throwing out really good guesses. The issue is that there's 50 states and only five on this list. But I want to know why, Lou, why you think Florida.
Because it's a very tough state to poll accurately. It has historically been a bellwether, though it has been trending red. But I would say even what motivates it to be a red state is particularly interesting, given the fact that the Hispanic population is partly what drives it red, which is different than most of the country. And it's been one of the closer states in a lot of elections. I mean, in the pre-Trump era, at least. So... It's also, hasn't it been, no president has won the presidency without winning Florida, with the exception, of course, of 2020. I think that was the case for like several cycles.
Did Obama win in 2012?
I think so.
I think you're thinking of Ohio. I think 2020 was the first year.
That streak was way longer. That streak was like 150 years. So, gotcha. Yeah, Obama won Florida in 2012. So
I was wrong. It's a Republican has not... Every time the Republican has won Ohio, they've won the White House. And this was the first time that did not happen.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Everything you said makes sense. I didn't think too much about sort of how a very large portion of the population who tends to, in the rest of the country, vote with one party in Florida is increasingly not voting with that party, and that's a really good point. I think if I were to alter my list, Florida would have replaced four or five, because I don't love that four and five are on the list for a similar reason.
I'm going to throw out North Carolina.
Not North Carolina. I didn't include it. I think it's pretty well defined as a purple state, and I think it makes sense. North Carolina, to me, makes sense. But if you think that there's something specific...
More so at the state level, Republicans tend to dominate. And that's the fact that... And that's because of the fact that North Carolina is statistically the most gerrymandered state in the union. Looking at North Carolina's electoral map, I think that in and of itself is the best advertisement for why gerrymandering needs to be abolished.
Oh, that makes sense. And I will say, unfortunately, with the way our system is set up, that's more common than it should
be. Right.
All right, still missing three. And I'll give you a clue. None of the remaining three states are large states by population. They all are they're all on the smaller side.
Alaska.
I was thinking Alaska.
It is number four.
We take those!
And for the reasons we know, tend to vote more so by the individual and specific ideology versus party leanings, which is not as common in our system.
It's also not a very Trumpy state. Like, Biden almost won Alaska. Like, he actually almost did.
Alaska has the highest discrepancy in gender ratio. I think Alaska's like 54% male or something like that, which is just odd.
Also, what's funny about Alaska is they socialize the profits of their oil industry, which is for a state that has significant Republican representation, kind of an interesting quagmire. Like, I mean, in terms of what the current Republican Party stands for, because you don't see that kind of idea proposed in the bluest of blue states, let alone.
See, that doesn't baffle me at all, because I think the current Republican base loathes the word socialism, but loves what it does for them in practice.
Well,
so
correct.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Correct, but that in itself is confusing. Like, we might be able to understand it, but there's no logic behind that.
Yeah, I think maybe the folly is to try and find some logic in it. I like that Lou and I have been on the same wavelength with most of these picks. I am going to throw out West Virginia.
West Virginia is not on the list.
It's,
but I will say, so my number two is on the list for the same reason you would think West Virginia is on the list. If that's if that's a clue.
Yeah, I think it definitely is.
Maine.
Maine's number five. They are not afraid to elect the independent, the outsider, the Trump before Trump existed. What was it? What was his name?
Paul LePage.
I know it was Les something. Just a weird state in how it's set up. And also one of only two states in the country that through their electoral college divides their votes or their who receives. I don't know how to say this. You know what I'm trying to say.
They split
It's difficult to articulate because the process is beyond the comprehension of 99% of people. And I mean that sincerely. Like, I'm taking a course just in the Electoral College now. You need a PhD to understand how it actually works, which is, I think, a problem. So I don't know if this is necessarily right, but I'm going to throw out Arizona.
It is not Arizona.
Some extra salt.
But Arizona is a weird state. It is a politically confusing state. It's definitely sort of like slowly moved more to the left, but is it really? It's not a blue state. It definitely is a purple state, but they have two Democratic senators currently.
One and a half Democratic senators.
Yes,
that's true. But I see Arizona as like a new Virginia. Right, it's like it's like an increasingly blue state that's still probably going to elect Republicans from time to time.
I see Arizona less as a purple state, and I think it's just a red state that hates Trump.
It characterizes the Republicans, but the fact that Phoenix and Maricopa County basically decides the elections. Mm-hmm. Has more to do with the fact that there's an influx of population.
Lou, it's your guess, but Corey, I'm just going to say, so number two, is it still falls in that category of not being a very populist state?
Correct.
Watch this be like something totally out of left field.
Well, like, there's a finite number of states.
That's true, but New Hampshire?
It is not New Hampshire.
I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
New Hampshire is strange too, just like sort of the rest of New England. But I did not include New Hampshire on this list.
Oh, I think I got it.
Let's see.
Low population, like West Virginia. Montana, more like Moncanta.
No, it's not.
Damn
Montana.
It.
All right. I need to think of a clue.
No, there's a finite number of states. We'll figure it out.
We got to be able
we'll
to
figure
get
it out. We got it.
Okay.
So just run through the list for us. We got Massachusetts. We're missing two. Three was what?
Minnesota. Four was Alaska. Five was Maine.
Okay.
Wisconsin.
Lou got it. It's okay. It's over. Historically, kind of flip-floppy in terms of presidential elections. The reason that this is number two is I looked at all states, and when you look at the two senators from the state, I think they are the two most politically opposed, or politically like the furthest different, from each other from
one state. I think that's state. Fair.
You have Ron Johnson, who is the Trumpiest Trumpy senator that there ever could be. And then you have Tammy Baldwin, the first openly lesbian senator, who is always on the left side, caucusing with the Democrats, working with the Democrats, voting with the Democrats. I couldn't think of a state where you had two people who served together as senators that were more diametrically opposed. And also, their governorship is always weird. I mean, they have Tony Evers right now, who barely won. And then before that, it was, remind me his name, Scott. Exactly. Who was
Scott
horrible.
Scott Walker.
He was way more on the right side. So it's very strange.
Paul
the people
Ryan
that they elect.
Too? Yeah.
Paul Ryan's like moderate in a sense, in some ways.
I think he's pretty right wing, but he's not weird, but it's like weird. He himself is not weird. It's just not necessarily a person you'd expect to come from Wisconsin.
Exactly. So I thought the people that they send, just the opposite, or the way that they're on the other sides of the spectrum from each other. That's why I put it at number two.
You sold me on it a little bit. I don't know about number two, but I could see it being on the
yeah,
list.
Yeah, you sold me on it. Again, not. I don't know if I see it as number two. The senator thing is an interesting fluke.
But so, Corey, just run through the list once more.
Number one, Massachusetts. Number two, Wisconsin. Three, Minnesota. Four, Alaska. And five, Maine.
I think I would take off Alaska and I would put on Pennsylvania. But that being said, I like the list. You sold me on a lot of these picks. I like the list.
Thanks for indulging me in my little bit of scrambling and coming up with a list. I wanted to do something that was like just totally made up based on like stats and history. And I really am interested in like elections. So I wanted to go with that. So that's sort of where that list focused.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, first episode of season four, bedshitting potential was definitely high, and you didn't embarrass your family, so good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Anyway, so earlier in the week, the bipartisan infrastructure bill finally passed. $1 trillion for, well, we'll tell you what it's for.
Hard infrastructure.
Generally speaking, yeah. So I'll give you a quick breakdown. So we get $110 billion for roads and bridges that was sorely needed, and we are very excited to have that. I think that's actually a decent amount of money for this. And unlike the rest of the bill, spoiler alert, I think that this is actually a decent amount of money. Transit and rail is going to receive an extra $40 billion. I don't think that's going to do a ton, although I do believe it's going to be enough to increase reliability and make our transit system a little bit more efficient. I would have liked to see more for the transit and rail system. You know, I'm a fan of the bullet train idea, although not everybody is, and I fully acknowledge that. This is nowhere near enough money to do what I wanted to do. $65 billion going to increasing the country's broadband infrastructure, specifically lower-income households gaining internet service. With COVID, that's been a big issue, and that's going to help, I think, a lot of low-income families out. If you're unaware, internet access was actually named a basic human right by the UN fairly recently. You can think of that what you will, but it's in there. $17 billion to upgrade airports, ports, and waterways. This does not seem like a lot to me, but people in the industry have said it is going to help not necessarily improve our current infrastructure, but make the necessary repairs to our current infrastructure that need to be made. So it's essentially the bare minimum, but
hey, the bare minimum is better than nothing more often than not. We have $7.5 billion aimed at the purchase of electric vehicles for, I think, mostly government-run agencies. Like, I know this is going to, I know a lot of this money is going towards placing mail trucks with electric vehicles. I know it's also going towards things like buses and ferries. So that'll be nice to see. Proving power and waterways, $65 billion towards the electrical grid. I think this is mostly going towards laying new lines, mostly in the Midwest, I think, to help wind. A lot of where you're able to develop clean energy projects are in areas where people don't live, and you just need to have that practical problem of getting that power to where people live.
Mm-hmm.
$65 billion. So I was talking to my dad. For those of you who don't know, he's in this industry. He works for a utility company. He and I both kind of had the same reaction to this. $65 billion is nothing. It's going to do very little. Nowhere near enough to do what we need to do. I didn't mention that $65 billion was in part going to waterways. Hopefully, they claim that'll help replace, you know, pipes that need to be replaced and everything. I know in New York City, in my building, we have to redo what we have to shut down because our plumbing infrastructure is crap all the time. So I can't, if any of this money goes to help out that problem, I'll be very, very happy. And then the last portion here, $21 billion to go into what they title it environmental remediation. I believe that's mostly Superfund and brown site cleanup. Essentially what that means is we take areas that have been contaminated and we try to repurpose them, clean them up so they can be reused for greener purposes. That's things like, you know, abandoned mines, chemical plants, that sort of thing. New Jersey has a lot of those. I think we actually have the most of any other state. I think we also have the most effective brown site and environmental remediation program in the country as a result. So
it's because a substantial portion of our power comes from nuclear power.
That's true. And a substantial portion of our power will continue to come from New Jersey because our offshore wind farm project, we will soon be leading the nation in offshore wind. I am very proud to say. But $21 billion to help clean up that. And so that's what's in the bill.
Is it good? Yes. I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. But agreed. There's a big but here. When you pass bills, you run the risk, if not going bold enough and not spending enough money, to not make a material impact such that the average person is going to see the results of that bill and then not feel like their tax dollars were wasted. That's the problem. That's what I'm scared of. That's what I'm scared of. More so with the scaled back, build back better legislation than I am with this. But because they're scaling it back, you are not seeing the synergistic effects of that spending.
I mean, you can make a very good argument that that was the problem with TARP.
In hindsight, that was. In hindsight, because Larry Summers said, oh, well, we can't go over the T word.
And Obama went along with that reasoning, too. Let's not absolve him here. But
no, but he went along with it because he trusted those advisors. They knew better than he did at the time.
And in hindsight, we know that they needed somewhere in the ballpark of, I think, $1.1 trillion to do what they wanted to do. I think they only got $700 billion. So the economy recovered slower as a result. It wasn't enough money. And I kind of take the more insidious approach of Mitch McConnell knew that when he agreed to $700 billion.
And that's the problem. You end up wasting taxpayer dollars, not because you don't get improvements, but because you leverage all this political capital. You leverage all this political capital, and it does nothing for you. In the worst case, it backfires. Because then the attack ads are, Democrats tax and spend, and all they do, what do you get for it? Nothing. It's like, you're like, what the, like, come on. Like, that's the trap you run into. And to me, it's not that you can't, it's the answer is not to say do nothing. The answer is to say, don't be afraid to commit to your programs and then make the case to your voters that this is going to make a material impact on you in all 50 states. Mm-hmm. Every state's going to get something for this. And that's what it has to be.
And to me, this is a failing on, in part, Biden, but I'd say mostly Democrats in Congress and the media, of kind of falling into this trap of, we know the Republicans are going to call this socialism no matter what. No matter what. It doesn't matter what we do. Marjorie Taylor Greene called the BIF the communist takeover of America in earlier this week when it passed, even though many Republicans voted for it. She, I think, tweeted also the name of every Republican who voted in favor of it and demanded basically their resignation and that, you know, they need to run people against them in the future because they had the audacity to vote for infrastructure spending. Mm-hmm. I think Democrats kind of fall into this trap, and the media also has a big part to play in this, of it was really stupid to include the amount of money that this was going to cost in the headline of this bill. Just philosophically, forget politics for a second, just philosophically, price should be the thing that you talk about last. The first thing you need to acknowledge is that, okay, there's a problem here. This is how we want to solve it. Then the last thing you talk about is this is how much it's going to cost, or this is how much we're willing to spend on it. Biden should have done a better job, and Democrats in Congress who were trying to sell the bill should have done a better job explaining, this is the state of our infrastructure right now, and this is what we need to do to fix it. The last thing they should have brought up is, this is how much money it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And if Republicans really think we're spending too much money, then they need to come to us and they need to tell us exactly what we need to cut from the bill. Which all but the fact that they brought up price first, it played right into the Republicans' hands. They were able to say, look, this is way too much money. And they didn't even have to make a salient argument as to why it was too much money.
No, and too much money is a value judgment too. It's arbitrary.
Oh, 100%.
You're sitting there trying to say, oh, well, it begins with a T, so it's too expensive.
I mean, the most asinine argument out there is that we can't afford it. Like, the majority of people don't realize that we're not spending this all at once. This is over the course of 10 years.
Well, that's the other failing of the way it's reported, is they report, 100%. They say $1 trillion over 10 years. And then they say it like it's a footnote. And I'm like, no, what I see.
That's actually quite significant.
What I see is 1.2 trillion divided by 10. Mm-hmm. That's what I see. That's, so it's really only a 1.2. No, it's a $120 billion bill. That's what I hear.
And by the way, this is adding zero to the deficit. Like, that's also really important here. And right. That's the point that's also lost in it.
I think the Democratic messaging of it costs zero is not a good thing to say. I think what they needed to say was it does not add to the debt. It does not add to the deficit.
Exactly.
Because that would make people feel like it's a better faith argument. And when they hear it costs zero,
they're like, oh, well, they're just trying to pull the wall over our eyes here. Obviously, it doesn't cost zero.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's sort of that's the mistake that they made. But it is just a feeling of how it's reported, because they see what the spending package is. And I think that's the problem. I mean, you know me. I love infrastructure. Spend all the money on it. I mean, I wish we had high-speed rail. and great tunnels and awesome airports.
We're getting like a new tunnel, by the way, right?
I suppose so, yes.
The Gateway Tunnel, I think it's called. Yeah.
So, like, I just hope this yields dividends that people see. I'm not convinced it will yet, but I'm happy to be proven wrong. Some things that make me very happy in this bill are the provisions for electric cars and, like, the electric power grid, that infrastructure. That, to me, is the most important frontier. Is you can solve a hell of a lot of problems. I will grant the United States can't quite be like Europe because it's not quite as dense. So like high speed rail has to be done differently. But if you are at the forefront of electric cars, you solve a lot of the problems of cars.
Yeah.
And then if you start switching out fossil fuels for mass energy generation on the grid, you also solve a lot of issues with how you power those electric cars. And then that becomes an easy way to just kill a lot of excessive emissions.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you know, I'm happy that the bill exists and I'm happy that it's there. At the same time, you know, we did a whole thing on NIMBYism a few months ago and like why infrastructure costs so much in America when this bill was just a thought. And the biggest critique you and I had back then was that this wasn't enough money. You and I think threw out the number of $4 trillion is really like more what we need, and that would be more appropriate. Again, it's all about how you spend it, but I hope we're wrong and I hope it is enough money, but we're not going to be. And you kind of have to reconcile this. We don't oppose it because we didn't get everything we wanted. I think you and I are upset more in the sense that we're just annoyed that it's not the most efficient use of tax dollars, because if you had spent more money, you would yield better results per dollar.
Right? I'm also upset because you use a lot of political capital to get something like this done, and it's not necessarily going to yield both literally in the sense of the infrastructure you want done and metaphorically in the win that it deserves to be. And that to me is the concern. Passing this and getting projects ready to go helps Democrats for the 2022 midterms. It does, because it shows you can get things done. They would have been dead in the water if they didn't pass this. But I'm not convinced passing it wins them anything. It might win them a few seats. It might keep Malinowski's seat, for example. It might.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily stop the red wave.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot of different factors that go into that. I think gerrymandering being the biggest one. And as far as the other legislation that's holed up in Congress right now is concerned, I think that Joe Manchin making a carve out of the filibuster exemption for voting rights bills and for those to be passed, I think it's a possibility. I really do. I'm cautiously optimistic about that. And to me, that needs to be their number one priority, is passing the, I hate that the media is calling it the Joe Manchin voting rights bill, because he approved it. He didn't do the bulk.
I'm
going to
tell you what, Joe Manchin got exactly what he wanted there.
I know. It really pisses me off.
It goes from the John Lewis Voting Rights Act to the Joe Manchin Voting Rights Bill.
Which, by the way, if you,
which is exactly, you still, he loves being in the front of the conversation.
I know. And it's like, here's the thing. It should be the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, but if we're not going to be calling it that, it should be called the Amy Klobuchar Voting Rights Act, because she did 90% of the work on it. But I don't want to be shitting on this bill, because I actually love this bill and I really want it to pass. I love everything about this bill.
I hope it does.
Yeah. And I'm again cautiously optimistic that it will, but I've been disappointed before. So what do you think that the Biff passing, what does this mean now for the whole Build Back Better agenda? Because like I said, Biden's top priority right now, in my opinion, should be the voting rights bill. His second top priority should be getting as many corporations as possible to mandate vaccination and end the pandemic. And he needs to set a deadline for this thing to end. Because at this point, politically, and I feel terrible saying this, doing the right thing in terms of public health is no longer tenable, in my opinion. You need to do what's politically expedient, and that's end this thing. Because
Here's the problem. Let me finish real quick.
There's a lot of problems with what I'm saying. I fully recognize that. But people are pissed off about the pandemic and they're pissed off about inflation. And the two things are inextricably linked. The problems with supply chains are due almost entirely to the pandemic continuing to rage.
So I have a few thoughts.
Let me tell you a couple of three things.
So the inflation conversation, I never saw it. I probably should. I work in Jersey politics. The inflation conversation excites me, actually.
Me too.
It excites me because it doesn't scare me. Now, before I turn my nose up at people before it sounds like I turn my nose up at people who are struggling to pay bills, my gas, my fuel bill for like my car went up $100. It went from $300 in the month of September to $400 in October. I was driving more, but it does have a lot to do with gas prices.
I drive a 2013 luxury vehicle. My gas prices are beyond insane. It costs me like $60 to fill up now.
Do you drive a Volvo too?
Yeah.
Yeah, so do I.
yeah, exactly.
And you can't use regular gas. Like, I get it. I get it. I understand what that feels like, right? Like, milk is more expensive by 50 cents. So like the milk that I usually get, which is more expensive, but it's like, it was like $4.50. Now it's like $5. I get, you know, like,
you know what's taking a beating? My favorite pasta dish that I love to cook has bacon as one of its ingredients. Bacon has gone through the roof.
Look,
it's like $15 for a thing of bacon now.
Even Tinder Gold got more expensive. And it's,
oh, screw that.
But like, I understand that prices are going up. I'm not worried that prices are going up because they should. They haven't for 10 years. So if anything, the two things that scare me about the future of the economy is not inflation. We had basically zero interest rates forever, okay, for like 10 years. And inflation was consistently at 1%, which is fairly low. And if there were ever an amount of deflation, there was not a lot of wiggle room. You have a new monetary policy paradigm. When you get into 4%, 5% inflation, everyone's like, whoa. But it's like, this was overdue. This was overdue irrespective of a pandemic. The pandemic is just galvanizing this. If you see 5% inflation for a year fall back down to like 2 and then it stays, that's okay. That's fine. The concerns here are, will wages keep up or outpace, which in this extraordinarily tight labor market, it might. And that actually makes me very optimistic.
And you know what? I don't want to cut you off, but one thing I've read today is a lot more industries are beginning to unionize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, laborers who work for nonprofit corporations are beginning to unionize. That's like a big sector that's beginning to unionize, which is really fascinating to me. And I kind of think that, look, there's a lot that would work to benefit there. I think, you know, if legal aid paid like a 20% boost in their wages, you would get a lot of top tier law student or recent law graduates working there as opposed to big law firms.
I think a push to unionization too probably is a result of stagnant wages and the inflation going up. People, that's a problem you see. It's a problem you see with low inflation economies. It changes the incentive structure.
Now, I do want to just real quick add in, I think the push to unionization is also being driven by people being opposed to vaccine mandates. We've seen that as a cudgel in some industries, that a union has an obligation to represent every single one of its members' interests. And unions are kind of being forced into these anti-vax mandate positions, even though the vast majority of their workers and members don't believe in them, because a minority do. We see that in every unionized industry, from police to baseball.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
But I don't see that as a long-term issue, to be honest with you.
No, but I think with increasing inflation, it creates a greater sense of urgency to get a better deal, which I think is important, because when you have low inflation or disinflation or even deflation, the urgency to spend a dollar now is decreased, and the urgency to get a raise doesn't really exist. Low inflation is a problem, and like, I really believe that. And people are like, well, it eats away at savings. Blah, 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 blah. But I actually, the problem is predictable inflation. And that's what I think is scaring people now.
Was it Keynes who said inflation is healthy?
Most Keynesian economists say that. I don't know if it was Keynes, but most of them do. And it's some amount of that is good. The fear is not being able to control it, but what I would go out on a limb on here is that the way the Fed controls inflation is to tighten up interest rates, and interest rates are still very low. They have a lot of wiggle room. They got a lot of wiggle room.
I was gonna say, the one thing I do have confidence in is that the Fed knows what they're doing. Like, I think history kind of proves that.
Hmm.
Even though Trump nominated somebody who wants to go back on the gold standard, the majority of the Fed still knows what they're doing.
We are seeing what's very exciting about what we're seeing now in the economy.
And just as a addition to that, Janet Yellen knows what she's doing.
She does. And we are seeing experiments. What I love about this makes me so happy. It's like, we are seeing experiments in the economy in real time, putting modern monetary theory to the test. A real tangible amount of inflation and an extremely tight labor market, which can be really good. It can be really good if you can prove the power of fiat currency, what an actual inflationary trend looks like, and try to drive wages up at the same time. That's huge. That could be really powerful. And it's never quite been tried before in the same way.
You know what's funny is, so my mom, probably the smartest economist I know, one thing that she always says when she talks economics is that what's so exciting and what's so beautiful about economics is that it's a field that it's a science. I kind of hesitate to call it that, but it's a science that's
what do they call
somewhat,
the unfortunate science or the bastard science or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. But it's truly a field that's in its infancy. We know so little about how economies work. I heard an excellent interview. I wish I remember her name, but she was she was the first African female executive at Goldman Sachs. I think she was a vice president. And I always love hearing people who aren't American, what they think of American economics. She and an American economic policy. And she very clearly, or she said two things that I love. The first thing she said was, if any economist tells you they know what's going to happen, they're lying to your face. Because, again, economics is in, it's just their best guess, and economics is in its infancy as a discipline. And secondly, we have no idea how to make an economy better. We don't know if conservative or liberal economic policies work better. And quite frankly, history will tell us they've both done a pretty bad job. So those are two things she said that I thought were brilliant. I mean, yeah, I think it's an exciting time to be an economist, in just that we're going to learn so much more about what works and what doesn't. And that's all we really can do.
It's pretty cool.
And on that note, I think we can check out for the day. We've got quite a bit of content here for you. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode, in this season premiere of Legally Drunk. Big thank you to Corey. Big thank you to Lou. And big thank you to you, the humble listener. Be sure to check back soon for more great content. And until next time, we're out.